I'd like now to welcome Marilyn Mason. She's a psychologist, management consultant, and author. Her new book is Becoming a Genuine Leader, Succeed with Integrity by Exploring Your Past. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thanks, Marie-Charlotte. Good to be here.
It's great to have you here. Now, you have spent your life, or much of your life, observing, often from the outside, as a management consultant, as a corporate psychologist, management, the way it works, the way it doesn't work. And one of the things in the beginning of your book, which was really striking, was how much it costs companies and how much it costs the nation when managers don't do their jobs well.
Exactly. And that's partially what struck me when I realized, for instance, if you go to Google, you will find under Genuine Leader, there's 29 million hits. And yet how many companies are led by genuine leaders? And that's what struck me, because in the work that I did, I found that so much of it was at the top. My real title, chosen title, was Shadows in the Executive Suite. And the publisher wanted to sell more books, and so they wrote Becoming a Genuine Leader instead. But for me, it was that facing your shadow self, facing what you hadn't looked at in your own home, and going back and see who role did you play in your family? Who were you then? And what parts did you carry forward? What beliefs from that system did you carry forward into your work system? And, of course, blah. I mean, there it was. So many of them found that it was their family of origin, their first family, where they learned to be who they were as leaders. And they were still playing out the childhood roles. And once they did that work and looked back, they would often just strike themselves on the forehead and say, I can't believe I didn't see it. You know, it's a blind glimpse of the obvious.
Right.
And all I had to do was ask a certain amount of questions. But in an hour and a half interview, we typically could go back home and they could see what they had not been able to let go of and had taken forward, whether it was, I have to be the achiever because my father wanted me to be the achiever, or I don't matter. I don't matter really, so I better just stay backstage. So those are just some of the examples of what I saw and then led me to do at least an hour and a half interview on their first family with these executives, because they would be sent to me for what they called exit interviews. They were being fired by their board of directors.
Right.
And the one I put in the book, the one story, was the man who sat there in such arrogance and beautifully dressed. You know, he showed so well. And then I asked him what he thought he was there for. He said, oh, I suppose you want me to sit and talk mushy. That was his take on doing anything human. So what's important, I think, is to recognize we learned our best and our worst in our families, and we take it with us. And what's important is to know it.
Now, one of the things that people learn in their families is what's taboo? What is this area that you're not allowed to talk about? And that often shows up in a corporate culture that comes from the top down.
Exactly. And you can't talk about what is really going on. For instance, a company where the CEO was a real womanizer. And no one was talking about it. And, of course, it turned out that the corporate counsel was in the same kind of system from home. And it turned out the guy who blew the whistle, who finally broke his own family rule and said, oh, I've got to speak my truth. And he did. And, of course, he walked into the office and he was down three floors, no corner office, in a six-month contract. He was the vice president of that company.
So he was punished
for telling the truth.
Yeah.
And then he found out, you know, that in his own home, the family message was, you speak up and you're going to get the strap too. So he knew not to comment. And when these women came to him and said, the CEO is violating us, it's just awful. He said, oh, well, I will do the right thing. You know, I will be the good guy, because he was the good guy. And he went to the corporate counsel, and I said, so the corporate counsel plays golf with, vacations with, and celebrates the holidays with, that's who you went to? He said, he looked at me, and, you know, kind of a blank face stare. I said, and you wonder why you were let go?
Right, and so that sets up a situation which is so typical in business, which is that there's something that is an ethical wrong of some kind or a real problem, And the person you can go to is in cahoots with the leader who is...
Exactly.
Yeah, and we see this in the military. We see it everywhere.
In fact, the CEO was the one who gave me permission to talk to the rest of his direct reports, knowing that he paid them so much that they were not going to squeal.
Right.
I mean, that is really sad. That is sick. And so much of corporate America is sick.
And so you, as a psychologist and a consultant, come into that situation, and how do you start going about healing it?
Well, with this case that I just mentioned earlier, the only way the healing could happen was for him to leave. There was a 6-month contract on his desk. Now, could he have taken it on in the city? It's a big city, big money. He would never have won. And who would want to hire him? So for that to be successful, I wouldn't call it healing the system, but I would call it successful that he chose to leave. And when he left with dignity. He left with full pay and salaries because he has 3 teenage children, and that way he could afford to handle that. But in a way, I felt disappointed we couldn't take it on. But had we, it would have cost him millions of dollars. This is a big company, and he had no chance, and that's what's sad because you're standing up. But there are other situations where, indeed, it was turned around because the corporate head, the top man, and I say man because most of them were all men, that he chose to do the right thing and look at himself, look at the employees, and start to become human. Those are wonderful stories, Mary Charlotte.
In your book, one of the things that I read was some qualities of good leaders. They're open to feedback. They don't expect perfection. They're empathetic and accepting. That sounds like good parenting.
And it is, isn't it? What really strikes me is how many of those people are able to stay in place. Did you know that 89% of the corporate leaders who are released because of attitude? 89%. It's huge. And when you look at who is leading, the other factor that changed my book for me totally was the thought of the introverted leader. Because everyone seems to rate people who talk a lot and talk first are smartest. Not true. The major companies in our nation that are leading successfully are led by introverts.
Really?
Did you, and I can say the name here, he's in the book, Rick Schneiders, do you know of him? Rick was with Sysco Foods. And he worked at his dad's little grocery store in Iowa and said, well, I'll never work in the food business when he left home. Of course, he ended up at top dog and board chair of Sysco Foods. People don't know the name Rick Schneiders, but we do know that he is an introverted leader. It was Susan Bain who wrote a book called Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. And so her research shows that 1/3 to 1/2 of us are introverts. And what I have found in my consulting work is so many introverts are acting as if they're extroverts. It's exhausting.
I hear that, having been the shyest child in the world and having had to learn, and St. John's College was actually very helpful for that, to speak out loud.
And at Harvard, which is the major training base, of course, for these CEOs, when she interviewed them, they said they just had to work so hard at playing the role of extroverts. And for so many of them, that wasn't who they were. And so when you look at that, people going in, and I've had clients who said, this is how you sit. You put your arms on the chair, feet planted. They even have all the nonverbals down to look as if they're extroverts. And they work hard at it in their training. And so you enter under a false pretense.
And that never works.
It doesn't. And my wonderful, wonderful business mentor, Harry Lipson, said when I asked, why is this going on, that they're being sent to me and they're being released. And he said, oh, well, they were hired for narcissism, domination, and control. I thought, what a way to hire someone. And I hope that that's changing now. I think it is. But I think what a lot of people don't realize, too, is when I write about becoming a genuine leader, it might be in your local organization. It's in your family, for sure. As you said, it's good parenting. You know, you do see it. So you see the leadership. It's not just for the corporate heads. When I'm talking about leading, I'm talking about in your community, in your temple, in your church, whatever. It's where you lead, and we all do lead in some ways.
We're talking to Marilyn Mason about her book, Becoming a Genuine Leader. There are some interesting stories in your book. The book is a book of stories, as business is really a world of stories, case histories. And there are situations where you have come in to a system where it's a business where, for example, one person is an alcoholic. And before you can really do anything, there needs to be an intervention. And so you are put in a position of basically, again, shining the light on the thing that nobody's talking about. And sometimes it works.
Yeah, it worked beautifully. In fact, if you're thinking of the story I am, I asked permission after doing personal interviews with each one of the heads of this family business. I found out when I talked to the father, who was the head of the company, I got back home. And I call back up to the company because I always sit in with them and give them some feedback. And then I said, you talk and decide whether you want to hire me or not with my not being in the room. Got home that day and I realized I had interviewed everyone and talked about the family business. And I never asked about the mom. And so I called back up. Oh, yeah, well, she died. She died of alcoholism. Then it hit me. It was scotch. I did smell in that cup in the boardroom in the morning.
Yeah, the coffee cup didn't have coffee in it. It had
scotch in it. And I was dumbfounded that, because I was very well trained in the field of addiction, and that the system is the strongest. And then it hit me, that was scotch. And so I put my family therapy hat back on and asked if I could have permission to talk with them about the family. And so I did a set of interviews with each of them, and it turned out they all talked about that. The one with the booze in the boardroom and how afraid they were. They thought, the father said, I thought, well, if I kept him here at hand, then he wouldn't go off and drink. And of course he did. I mean, he was drinking at work. And so the dad said he was so afraid. I said, of what? He said, well, my wife died of alcoholism. I said, your son's killing himself. And so I came back up and did an intervention with the family, and we all met. And then the family alcoholic came in, not realizing there was a bag already packed for treatment to go. And when he heard his wife talk, and she said, when you passed out on our marriage anniversary night, she said, I knew I had to do something. And they had three children. He was driving around town drunk. And so we were on the same plane going back to Minnesota. I put up my newspaper. He saw me anyway. He went into successful treatment, came back to the company. It was wonderful. But it was because I stepped over that line as a consultant and could deal with what was going on in the family. Most consultants don't do that.
Well, most consultants aren't also psychologists.
Well, that's true.
And that's something that you brought to it. Now, we've talked about the qualities, or some of the qualities of a good leader, but one thing that I really wonder about, it seems to me that to some extent anybody can learn some leadership skills the way anybody can learn to play the piano or something like that. But if you're going to be good, don't you have to have a natural gift for it?
Well, there's a lot of debate around some of the leading leaders in our country who would say, you know, you either have it or you don't. And I remember a mentor of mine saying, you can teach what it is, you can teach how to do it, you can never teach how to be it. And that's why in my book I have a lot of exercises for people to enter into to look at who they really are. And can they be vulnerable? Can they say, I'm wrong? I'm sorry I made a mistake. Can they be that real? And if they can't, I don't see how they can be a good leader. I mean, you have to be able to be real yourself, genuine yourself. One client I worked with, he was getting ready to retire, a huge finance firm, and he decided to take a risk. And he wrote a beautiful piece of poetry at his closing session with his teammates. And that means the head of this corporation. And they did not know what to do with it. I mean, you know, you have to know where you can be vulnerable and not. And he took a risk, and he read this wonderful poem he wrote. And it wasn't slushy or gushy. It was just a lovely piece, maybe of the Wallace Stevens variety. But it was sad to see him standing there and no response. And that was tough.
Because they were so unused to somebody being emotionally genuine.
Yeah, and they didn't know what to do with him. And he said it was really hard, but he was glad he did it. But, you know, it takes that kind of work that Brené Brown writes about being vulnerable, about facing your shame, about knowing who you are, and having the daring to speak your truth. And those that dare greatly are the ones who can be vulnerable. Bill George, who's on the cover of my book, said now that he's done years of personal work, years, he did not start there. He's just a living proof of how it can change in life. But he said now when he's at Harvard and he is vulnerable with other professors, they don't know what to do with him.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I mean, there are so many different corporate cultures, but many of them in this society are what you might call mean, ruthless. I mean, we have this horrible example that has come up recently of was it Walmart doing food drives for its employees? And, I mean, a company where it does not pay its employees enough so that they can eat?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't care how authentic you are at the top of that. You're as blind as you can possibly be.
Well, and I think most of us would discount that kind of openness that we hear from them. Because the ones who are genuine have companies that Ari DeGeis wrote about years ago called The Living Company. Those are companies that recognize their employees are people that are holding the communities together and that are genuine leaders. And I asked a lot of my clients to read that book, The Living Company. There's a place in the Baja where I go because it's so moving to me that the leadership is genuine. The leadership, no one wants to leave there. Some of the employees have been there 55 years.
What kind of a company is it?
Well, it's the world's largest ranch spa in North America. And they started a school for the deaf in the community. They started feeding programs for the children. I mean, they really connected with their community. And to see that and to know and the philanthropic work being done there through a foundation that they set up. More and more, of course, are setting up foundations. I know Coca-Cola is setting up a wonderful foundation, and that foundation is for water projects. So, you know, you look around and see, do you walk your talk? So when you read about the Walmarts, I tend to discount what they're doing. I will not go there to shop. I mean, that's my voice of no. When I know, or Nike, who was using sweatshops and then turned it around. But there are so many still at it out there. It's disgusting.
We're talking to Marilyn Mason about her book, Becoming a Genuine Leader, Succeed with Integrity by Exploring Your Past. Some of the leaders that you talk about in the book and some of the big changes in leadership, although perhaps not big enough, is women taking leadership in corporate America. We still haven't really gotten all that far when
No.
you consider how far we've gotten in other professions.
Absolutely not. When you look at the fact that, what is it, 4% are heads of companies here?
Yeah.
4% in this age? I mean, what's wrong here?
Yeah, because we're half of doctors now. We're
yeah.
a huge percentage of professors and so on.
Yeah. And, you know, when I think about what happens, I think about what's happening in Europe. And they're the ones who started. One area where we've seen the major changes, it is in the composition of boards. And Norway started with a requirement that all publicly held companies had to have at least 40% women on their boards, not to exceed 60%. And then Spain jumped in, Italy, Belgium, the Netherlands, and France. We're not there yet, but hopefully.
We're not there at all.
No. Oh, no.
And it's interesting. I mean, Sally Bingham was on the show recently, and she talked about what it was like when she joined the board of her family company. As a woman, she was expected to keep quiet, and instead she brought up some real problems. I mean, financial problems and mismanagement, and was severely punished for it.
Yeah.
And the dynamics, I mean, for just not only the numbers, but what happens when women start to join an all-male board in the United States, what does that look like in your experience?
Well, in my experience, I hear horrific stories that one woman, in fact, talked about trying to bring forth the more feminine elements, feminist elements, into a discussion about fairness, about equality, etc. And she found that she could not be heard by being vulnerable, by being real. It did not work. And that was her hope, was that they might start to listen. And in fact, she left the board. And it was so sad. Other friends of mine who are on and getting paid well for corporate boards tend to stick to the financials. That seems to be that's where women have credibility, is in the financials and knowing about the P&Ls and being able to discuss those. But they find that it's so hard to crack that threshold. But I do know women who are on the, for instance, the board of Southwest Airlines, had a long talk with them, and they said, it is a wonderful board because you can be real. But don't you see that reflected in the company also, in the public domain? We do see that.
Yeah.
And another one was from Coca-Cola's board, who said, it's not quite the Southwest Airlines board, but they are indeed getting more real and more genuine. I have had men come into me from their board meetings in tears. They were so humiliated. So imagine what it's like for a woman who hasn't learned to do that tough stuff and to use that shield, who come in as a corporate board member. I mean, it is horrific. The stories from men and women, not just women, men and women, are devastating.
You bring up a number of stories in your book about women who bring up ethical issues. And it seems like, I mean, I don't know if women are more likely to bring up ethical issues.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. If you look at the whistleblowers, they're women. And
Not all of them. We've got a Snowden.
Well, we do. That's true. That's true. But before that, which is when I was writing, the majority are women. You know, the Aaron Brockovich case, you look at any of the more recent cases, they've all been women who blew the whistle. And some of them were not in the military one. They were dependent on a husband at home with the kids. So it wasn't as though they had big financial backup. You know, they did.
So the risk was even bigger.
Oh, huge, yeah. Because they did what was the right thing to do.
There was an example of a woman working for a financial company, and she achieved top-level management status, and she refused to sign on to a tax return that was obviously fraudulent.
Oh, I know that case so well. She was devastated. She could not believe that she was the one woman in the circle of five of the top finance company in the nation. And they said, let it go. And, you know, we'll just oversee that. And she said, no, we won't. She said, I cannot stay if you do that. And she was ready to walk. And she was the one, I think, who shamed them into doing the right thing and saying, you are accountable for honorable tax returns. I don't care who you are at the nation's level.
Right. And it was some not-to-be-named famous person.
Yes.
High-profile person. And it does lead to some really big questions, because a lot of what goes on in American business is unethical, either on the level of they're doing unethical actions within, like the example you just mentioned, or they are so vastly underpaying their employees, or they're doing poor working conditions overseas and not taking responsibility for it, or they're contributing hugely to climate change or to environmental damage.
All of the above.
All of the above. And I wonder if women, not only being whistleblowers, but actually effecting change from within or trying to effect change from within is doing any good at all, because it seems like we're on a greased sled to a very bad place.
Yeah, I do think they're trying. I think when women, so many of them belong to women on corporate boards and those organizations where they do gather together and they talk about these issues, I do think they are really attempting to do it differently. And I think they are hiring differently. I hear this from my daughter-in-law, I put her in the book. She's with a huge company, and yet their company, as has been pointed out to me, there are often pockets within the organizations that are doing incredible change. And that's what we don't get to hear about. I do listen to MSNBC, so I get to hear some of the stories that are ongoing where people from within are making a difference. I hear the skepticism. I have it myself. Can they really do it? Because so often they get into that inner circle, and it's a group think. Rare is it that the woman client I mentioned who said, no, I will leave. I mean, that's exciting.
But mostly you adapt to the culture that you're in and try to be accepted within it before you try to change it.
Exactly. If you're smart, because if you're not, you're not going to last. That's why it was exciting to see a woman was named as the president of General Motors. She grew up in the company. She knows it. She was impressive when I heard her talk.
It'll be interesting to observe that and see how they do on making cars with higher gas mileage and
exactly
things
and
of that nature.
What they do about the carbon emission. I mean, it will be interesting to see. And how long does that take?
We're talking to Marilyn Mason about her book, Becoming a Genuine Leader, Succeed with Integrity by Exploring Your Past. And staying on the subject of women for a moment, are there qualities that women have, and obviously not all women are alike, there's very different styles that women have, particularly those who go into corporate leadership roles in the first place, but are there qualities that women have that make them natural leaders?
Yeah, a catalyst organization is one that did a lot of research on this. And yet at the same time, I want to say yes, there are qualities because women typically work more collaboratively and they're more working toward a we. Now I'm saying typically. That is not, you can't say men are, women are, because there are as many women who are ruthless, who want to get to the top, who will join that male think world and do it the old way. And that's disappointing. But the hope is that the women in leadership, as my daughter-in-law says, she has seen a lot of women who are able to be so cooperative and working with collegiality is so important. And then there are those women who are not at all that, you know? So you can't say men are, women are. But I do think in researching women's leadership that there are more women who are willing to look at how they can connect with people. Women want to heal. Women want to cook. I'm generalizing now. But women, for the most part, are more willing to work collaboratively, to say, what can we do? They've had to learn to cooperate to be family members. And it's women who do that so well.
Do you find that women tend to be more collaborative and inclusive the more women there are in the organization? So let's say,
yes.
I mean, if you have a lone woman versus them being even 30-40% of the department.
Yeah, and they even say that's true in the Senate in Washington, that the women get together. You know, there's just a different kind, typically a different kind of think that pervades that culture wherever it is. And it's easier when you have other women, you know, that you have women that you can turn to and have their, what they call their kitchen cabinet, or as I suggest, a personal board of directors. Who's your personal board?
What's a personal board of directors?
Well, the personal board of directors is, for instance, you might want one, because who do you go to turn to when you're thinking about programming, or when you're thinking about your own life issues, or maybe you're thinking about financial issues in your life? They wouldn't be the same people, but it's support that you need, and people who believe in you, and that you could trust not to talk behind your back about it.
Have you done that yourself?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I have my personal board of directors, and they feel free to give me feedback without my asking.
Interesting.
And, yeah, and I just think that especially for women. And now I'm talking with Bill George's son. He has his own little group that he is head of a, I forget how many billion-dollar company. But he, at age 40, has a personal board that he can go to. His father's generation was one where, oh, you don't want to reveal yourself. His father's generation, a small group of them, have learned how to do that too. And it surely makes a difference. Leadership is lonely. So a lot of the leaders, men and women, need to have the support that they can get from their friends who can say, hold up a mirror and say, do you see what you're doing? You know, that it's so important, because who do you turn to as a leader? You need to turn to other leaders.
Now, one of the things that I think is important for men and women both is work-life balance.
Huh.
There's a lot of men who get to be old and they realize that they don't know their wives and they didn't see their kids grow up, but they had stay-at-home wives who were the cook, the bill payer, the house cleaner, the gardener, the nurse, the caregiver, and everything else for free or for whatever, however they did their finances. Women tend not to have that, so they have a harder time rising to leadership positions that have those kinds of demands, but those kinds of demands are crazy in the first place.
They are. You're absolutely right. When I was doing a lot of therapeutic work, I used to call them my corporate families, because it was so true. The men had all the help they needed. The women were lonely at home, doing community work, etc. And so for a woman to go off and do that means a lot more paid help at home. That means, like Sheryl Sandberg said, you know, a husband who understands and gets it. But it is so true. I asked my daughter-in-law once, I said, what's the price you're paying? She said, of being with my daughter and my husband. You know, she couldn't have them all priority. And, you know, there they were, divorced.
Do you find that that's different in Europe? I mean, there are, it does seem that there are a lot more progressive policies, like people tend not to demand that their employees come in and work on weekends and things like that. I mean, people do seem to have more work-life balance. Their schools are better. Their insurance is paid for, things like that, pretty much across the board.
Yeah.
What about their work-life balance there? Is it better?
Oh, I think it is better, because I think they recognize the length of a work week. You know, how long should it be? Here, the work-life balance is totally work-life imbalance. It is not balanced at all. You know, you're expected on Wall Street. I remember hearing the stories from my own family, from my kids. You know, they bring the meals in at 2 a.m., and then they give you car service home, so then you can be back there at 8 a.m. I mean, how does anyone survive that? And when I've challenged it, I call it the Japanese work model. And they said, oh, no, that's the American model. That's how it happens. But then we see the decline in what's happening in America. Corporations, can we be surprised?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, what kind of good decisions are you able to make on 4 hours of sleep consistently in an atmosphere that's not only sleep-deprived and physically unhealthy, but so intensely competitive?
Oh, and they lose sight of who they are. Well, when we read the stories all the time, and even when you read companies, you know, the big companies that are the big consulting companies, where they recommend a company and someone like, what's his name from Enron, is serving a 6-year in jail. I mean, calling that a good company, that's going to be a leader in America? I don't think so. I think the ones that are led more often by introverts that look at their communities. Often when I've asked people, Mary Charlotte, how many family members do you realize totally are working for you? It's not just you, the employee, because the whole family makes sacrifices. And in the community, what does it cost or gain? And some of them are getting very wise at working with their communities, setting up foundations, helping school programs, etc. But even that is happening more out of our country than here.
One of the things that you mentioned in your book, which is also a problem, is that if a company is behaving ethically and pays its employees well and is turning a reasonable profit, they may not be making as much of a profit as one that is ruthless and is turning over better what they call value to its shareholders. And that's a big problem, because then people are going to buy the stock that is making more money instead of the company that is really doing service to its employees, community, and making a good product.
Well, I'm not so sure, because what we have is a company, for instance, Costco. The CEO is being paid $360,000 a year, plus stock options, for sure. But compared to the $5 million others are getting, I mean, that's low pay, right?
$5 million is a typical CEO salary in a company?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And so here's the head of Costco getting $360,000 plus stock shares. He goes around visiting the plants and, you know, talks to them. I mean, there are people buying stock in Costco because of that. And that is what gives me hope. When I read about the companies, there are listings now that one can turn to see which companies are doing best by their employees and by their communities. And so it's interesting to see those, you know, who's doing the best work out there.
And is the investment in those companies for those reasons
Yes.
actually affecting the market in general?
That's a good question, Mary Charlotte. I think it's heightening the awareness of the public. Then there's also companies, not to jump ship here, but for instance, I wrote about Steve King, who started building playground equipment. Our playground equipment here in Santa Fe down at the park is by his company. When he decided that he was ready to retire, what he did was set up an ESOP, which means he turned over his whole company to the employees. He said, they built this. They deserve it. I didn't do it alone. They did it. And so he is no longer, he's on a board, but they own the company now. They took all the shares, divided them. I mean, that's what can happen.
Yeah.
That's what can happen. And it is happening. When I look, I said Rancho La Puerta, where
the Mexican spa company.
Mexican-American. Yeah.
Yeah.
And with all that they've done there, and I look at him, Steve King, and what he's done, and set up a scholarship fund, and no one wants to leave those companies. They stay forever, of course. And I know it's a dilemma for some, because some of the companies, jumping over another track now, but some companies do what looks good and shows well philanthropically. And I had a call one day from a writing collective, in the biggest writing collective in America is in Minneapolis. And so this writers collective said, what do we do? One of their big donors, who was willing to set up a fund for the writers collective, is one that they would have protested. So their dilemma was, do they take the dirty money and wash it? Or what did they do?
What did they do?
They didn't take it.
Very interesting.
They didn't take it. They said they could not take it. But it's that kind of thing. A lot of companies do what looks good, but it's not from the heart.
Right, it's greenwashing and all those kinds of things.
Yeah.
We're talking to Marilyn Mason about her book, Becoming a Genuine Leader, Succeed with Integrity by Exploring Your Past. And there are many examples in this book. I mean, at the end of every chapter, there are, what would you call them, exercises or processes that people who are reading the book can do to really look within themselves. Do those work if you do them by yourself? Do they have to be done with a partner or counselor of some kind?
Well, what's amazing to me is that, well, first of all, yes, you can do it yourself. As I've said, you don't need to go into psychotherapy. You know, hopefully the exercises here are those that I have used in that context, you know, as the management consultant or as the psychologist of work here. That's what we would talk about. It's important to have a journal or someone you can talk to about this. And there's a woman in Seattle, I mentioned her in the book, that just blew me away, because she started doing these seminars using some of these exercises with CFOs, with company presidents, And I said, you got them to talk about their families and their shame? She said, absolutely. And so when I was doing a webinar one day, I asked that after I did my first webinar and the second one I was doing for this company, I asked that Molly could come in because I wanted her to tell her story. How did she get these guys to come in and tell their stories and look back in time and talk about their family shame? But there are people who are ready, and you're ready, you're ready. It was amazing to me that more and more people, I think, are willing to look and to look back.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think over the years, we have seen people having permission to be truth tellers, to talk about themselves. You know, at one time, you would never talk to anyone that you were seeing a therapist. And now today we shifted into coaches, and that's all right. But I think from talking to my clients, they reach a point in life where they say, is this all there is? I ask them, do your family members know you? And often I've sent a corporate CEO off to talk with his kids. They know inside that there's something missing, a hole in the heart, people say, but that they will go and do that work because they know it matters. They are human beings, and whatever it is that taps them to go to that place, Mary Charlotte, is so exciting to see and to witness. And I think it is the goodness in each of us that where there is a decency, if someone's half healthy, they want to become all of who they can be. They'll never become all of who they can be, but they can become more through following these procedures here and knowing yourself. It's the most powerful tool is to be self-aware.
There's a very simple exercise that you did with, I think it's in the first chapter, with some of the folks that you describe in this book, and people can probably do it themselves, but it's imagine, and men tend to do this, imagine that they're with their dad, and their dad, is that how it goes?
Yeah, it's a guided imagery. Some people thought I was hypnotizing them, which of course I was not, but I would just have them close their eyes, and I would semi-darken a room, and then start talking to them, and taking them back down the staircase into their past, into their home, and just observing, that's all, and then going to their room where they had their own space, whether they shared it or not. They had their own little place for their artifacts, their toys, their puzzles, their ball mitts, whatever. And then I had their dad, usually the dad figure, put his hands on his shoulders and tell him what he always needed to hear. And that's when I had to pass the Kleenex box. They found a human part of themselves, the boy inside who longed to hear. And it was touching to hear their stories. And they asked me to do a tape of it. I did a tape. They took it home so their wives could hear it. And it often changed their family dynamics. Often changed their family dynamics.
And something so simple as what I needed to hear from my dad,
yeah. It
also makes you think of people who are fathers today thinking forward about what their sons might need to hear.
Exactly. Exactly.
What do children need to hear?
The same thing. You're fine the way you are. I love you the way you are. Those are about the two messages that came through most profoundly. Some version of that, but it was all that they didn't have to push. They didn't. They were okay the way they were.
It's not rocket science.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, when people are good leaders, and they are coming from their authentic selves, as you've talked about, and have done some of that personal work that so many of us need to do, what is interesting is that they're both confident and humble. And if you see somebody who's really cocky in a leadership position, that can be a red flag.
Oh, totally. Totally. Because you know they're acting as if. One of the lines I put in my book is that the difference between Larry Ellison and God is that God knows he's not Larry Ellison.
There you have it.
I mean, that's it. You know, because when I see someone who is, for instance, a guy who came into my office, just strode across the room, put his rear end up on my desk and picked up my phone. Oh, where is the shameful story there?
Right, and so you go straight to that.
Yeah.
Somewhere in there, there's a story of shame.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can tell it in a heartbeat. When I see the false self, then I know that they are being phony. That they don't, because if you had permission to be real, you can be real. And I think that's why a lot of these folks realize how important it is not only to go back, but also to look at how they can make changes in their own family. Bill George gave his son permission through his own work, personal work, to go out and seek therapy, to seek all kinds of help and personal growth work. And so his son today can read poetry to his direct reports, can tear up with his direct reports at age 39. I mean, that's pretty marvelous.
Now, there is also a part of leadership that involves actually knowing what you're doing, knowing the industry, knowing the technical aspects of your job and things along those lines.
True. You have to have that. You need to know your industry. You need to know what's going on. That's why when I had lunch with Alan Weber, he pointed out to me that a lot of the leadership, he said, don't think, I said, well, you know, it's fish grows rotten from the head down, isn't it? And he said, no. It really changed a lot of my writing. Because as he pointed out, and my daughter-in-law pointed out, a lot of the good leadership comes from those pockets within the organizations where they really know what's going on. It could be the mail. It could be some IT division. I mean, who knows? But it's people who know the industry and their own role in it. So you have to have that in an organization. And sometimes they know more about it than the people at the top who are brought in to go out to schmooze for the money.
Right, right, yeah. Right. Now, have you ever come across, and it's a very small percentage of the population, but a disproportionate number of them do go into business, sociopaths, people who genuinely do not care about the feelings of others.
Absolutely, and there have been statistics on that. That there have been a high number of sociopaths who have gone into business. They're the glad handers. They're the egos. They're the narcissist types that go in, or the sociopaths who will be devious, who want to do things to look good. They will lie. And there's been far too much of that, that too many corporate consultants, frankly, don't pick up on.
What can be done about those people? Because those folks are really pretty bad for everybody but themselves.
What's interesting is that they typically don't call for help. They are exposed. Those are the leaders that get exposed. They are not the leaders who reach out for help. A lot
no,
of leaders.
No, because they don't want it. They don't.
Oh, no, no. They don't want to be found out.
Yeah.
But that's the Jeffrey Skillings who's in prison right now. You know, you look at some of those personalities, and that's where they are. I mean, they are the sociopaths. And why do they hire them? For the domination, narcissism, and control. As Harry said, I think he was right on.
Do you feel that the system as it exists now has the potential for real, profound change and still have a capitalist economy?
That's a good question. I do think so. I do think so. But I think it's going to be through people who get some of these concepts, do the personal work to recognize who they can be. I think the next generation of leaders, like the 40 under 40, like Jeff George, who can come in and be real, the more that these multi-billionaire companies can do that and show we can still make a profit, we can be real. And we can care about our families and our communities. Those are the living companies, and they can indeed do that.
Marilyn Mason is a psychologist, management consultant, and author. Her new book is Becoming a Genuine Leader, Succeed with Integrity by Exploring Your Past. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It was a pleasure, Mary Charlotte. Love being here.